Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning. We have a very different program today. The first and most different thing about this, listeners, and you may or may not care, but this program's actually been produced.
Being produced, in
southern Spain.
Being produced.
Yes. Where we are staying with friends as part of a visit to Spain, which you'll hear much more about. In an upcoming program.
Actually, some of it in this program.
But this program is a lot about wine with a sweet ending. How about that for a teaser?
Right. Good. Very good, Robert.
First off,
okay.
Try to imagine two things put together called the study of philosophy and the study of wine. It almost sounds like a non sequitur, but we found this wonderful author called Fritz Ohlhoff, who's at Western Michigan University, who wrote a symposium, and you'll find out what a symposium is, but a symposium finished up as a book, all about the philosophy of wine.
And you were fascinated by it.
I was. I read more of it than I expected I would, and we were delighted to welcome Fritz to the program.
Well, listeners, this may be surprising to you to know that a scholar, an assistant professor of philosophy, actually put together compiled a book of essays about wine and philosophy as a symposium on thinking and drinking. Now, what a great idea. Welcome to On the Menu, Fritz Ohlhoff.
Thank you.
And we already pointed out that we're not exactly rivals, but I'm the Wolverine, and he's from the Western Michigan University.
He's a Wamu, not an Emu. What are people from?
We're Broncos.
Yeah, we're Broncos.
That's right.
The Broncos. Okay, well, a Bronco doing philosophy about wine. Now, you call it on the front cover a symposium. Why is it a symposium rather than a colloquium or an anthology, and does it really matter?
Well, the symposium point goes back to this. I talk about this in the introduction, but in ancient Greece, philosophers had what were called symposia, which were effectively wine parties after dinner. They would retire to a special room and drink wine at a special vessel, and those were called symposia. And Plato wrote a dialogue called the Symposium, which was about one of these parties. And the word choice had to do with making this link between the role that wine had played in ancient Greece and the links that it had with philosophy.
It's really very intriguing. I mean, did they discover anything specially new and exciting because they were inebriated? Or?
Well, it's interesting. The Greeks actually drank their wine with water in it. They would either put two parts water or three parts water to one part wine.
And well, the Romans did that too, didn't they?
They did. They did also. And I just can't imagine taking my good wine and putting water into it. Though I guess they could drink more before they got inebriated.
I think the answer was the Greek wine in that day was all retsina. It had a resin in it to stop it from rotting. So,
yeah.
So the one way of making it palatable was to water it down.
Well, yeah, the Romans put honey in theirs too.
Yep, that's right.
But they also dried the grapes first. We learned all about drying grapes to make Amarone, which was a Roman tradition because it was a way that they discovered they could produce a wine that was able to last until the next harvest. Can you imagine what a terrible thing it would be to actually run out of wine sometime before you got a new supply?
That would be awful.
Yeah, well, apparently that's exactly what it was like. And so the tradition of growing grapes, which is still preserved today in the making of Amarone from the Valpolicella region in Italy, continues that tradition. But back to the philosophical aspects of wine. I mean, wine certainly causes you to think, sometimes perhaps in strange directions.
I think, again, historically, there's a good link between philosophy and wine, but even contemporarily, we when philosophers go to conferences, we sit around drinking wine. I think we do our best work after after we've had some wine together with each other.
Yeah, well, we pointed out that one of the professors at the University of Pittsburgh, when you were visiting here, actually was a wine writer, and as well as a philosophy of science professor.
Oh, you're talking about
Peter Makema.
You're talking about Dr. Makema.
Yeah.
That's right.
But how did you assemble that? How did you set about assembling the group of philosophers that you provided in the book?
Well, there was a conference on philosophy and wine in London in 2005. That had a few presenters. So I started contacting them, and then they it spread by word of mouth. We needed about, I think there's 18 essays, about 18 essays in the book. And, there's 19 essays in the book. And it was just some spread by word, and then I would get some emails from people who were interested in contributing. And there were a few winemakers that I wanted involved. So Paul Draper, who wrote the foreword, has a degree in philosophy from Stanford.
That's a really?
Oh, no, he's such a fabulous guy, such a great figure in the American wine industry.
He was great to work with. And then Warren Winiarski was...
Oh, yeah, we know Warren also.
Warren was ABD in political philosophy at the University of Chicago before he moved to California to start with wine.
Oh, that's when he chucked everything in, put his family in the station. He said he'd put his family in the station wagon and headed for California bought a vineyard. I think it's not quite that simple. He's sort of simplifying the story. I think he actually did go to work for somebody else as a winemaker in between.
That's right.
But he's a genuine character,
wasn't
too.
Wasn't he from Pittsburgh?
No, he was from Chicago.
Yep, oh, okay. He moved to Chicago.
Maybe he's always here for the wine festival.
He came in for the Pittsburgh Wine Festival, and we did talk to him. And in fact, some of my favorite quotes about wine, I stole because Warren quoted them.
Yeah, and he's a very smart guy.
I forget which one it is that said that wine is a daily reminder that God loves us. I think that was Thomas Jefferson, but it might have been Benjamin Franklin. And then the other one is, a day without wine is a day without sunshine.
That's a good one.
So whichever one of them it is, the opposite one said the other thing.
Yeah, my favorite though is the guy in the.
Oh yes, yeah. This is a philosophical one for you. People who
plant
grapes, plant vines, and people who build houses in stone believe in the future.
That's good.
And he's just a Slovenian winemaker, for heaven's sake.
He's very good.
But you've got so many different. You tackle so many different aspects of the subject. Give us a sample.
Well, the books. I mean, just quickly, the book's broken into five units. The first one's about art and wine, and that's basically just aesthetics, which is an area in philosophy. There's a unit about tasting and talking about wine, and what we're interested in there is how we use language to describe wine and how the language has changed over time.
That's a really good section because it you get various people demystifying all the bullshit words that are spoken describing wines.
That's actually one of my favorite units. There's one about critics and whether wine critics really enjoy any sort of privileged access to wine, or whether we could all do just as well as they do.
And that's another really good section as well.
Those are related. Those are both about language. The fourth unit is about aesthetics, about what makes wine better or worse. And you hear a lot of people talk about this. Some people say, "Oh, I like it, therefore it's good wine." And other people might say, "This is good wine, but I don't like it." And the relationship between whether we like something and whether or not it's any good—it's
like art.
I think it's complicated.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that I read, and when I got done, I still couldn't figure out what the philosopher's point of view was.
Well, they disagree. Philosophers disagree on everything.
Is that what makes the profession so rich?
It is. The next unit is about wine and metaphysics, and about what wines mean. That's a cool unit because there's another Randall Graham, who's the winemaker at Bonny Doon.
Oh, I love
that. And he studied. He has a degree in liberal arts from Santa Cruz, but it was heavily based in philosophy. And then Matt Kramer, who's a writer for Wine Spectator magazine, wrote in that unit too. And he wrote a really neat essay about the notion of terroir and what he thinks it means and trying to debunk it.
Yeah, I thought that was really good, and I didn't understand why he was trying to debunk it because it makes so much sense. That there indeed is such a thing as terroir, and the only thing is it's got a whole lot more components than the dirt. But it is an explanation. It's a way of explaining why wine A and wine B are different and what kind of things they express. The first one I turned to, of course, is the one that included George Tabor as one of the writers.
Right, that's the last unit in the book, which is about politics and economics of wine.
Yeah, he's very good. We've interviewed him. Yeah.
He is. He's very good.
We've read both his books, Judgment of Paris and To Cork or Not to Cork.
So listeners, this is from Peter, who doesn't have all the time in the world to read because he's very busy with On the Menu all the time. But I have to tell you.
Or drinking wine.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I enjoyed this book. I enjoyed it sober. I enjoyed it even more with a glass of wine, and I enjoyed it even more after two. And I would definitely encourage you to pick up a copy. You can get it through our website. It's a paperback. It's called Wine and Philosophy. And if you can't remember Wine and Philosophy, the author's name is Fritz, A-L-L-H-O-F-F, Orhoff.
Yes,
I think you should get yourself a copy. It would be a wonderful companion on a long plane journey in business of first class, where you can get wine anytime you want it.
Fritz, you sound like a regular guy and lots of fun.
Well, thanks. I try to be. You can't do serious philosophy all the time. This book is a lot of fun to do this book. I really enjoy it.
And next up, I understand, is whiskey, right?
Right. Now we're doing a sequel. There's actually three books in this series now. There's Wine and Philosophy, Food and Philosophy, and Beer and Philosophy. And now we're adding a fourth, which is Whiskey and Philosophy, which it'll be a year or so before that one's out.
So the other two are already in print?
Right. All three were released at the same time.
Oh, my
so
goodness.
Wine, beer, and food are already out, and whiskey will be another year or so.
Well, golly, were they done by the same publisher?
Yep, right. They're all in the same series. The series is called Epicurean Philosophy.
Well, we'll have to get those too.
Yeah, those are good. They're actually they all sold out the first printing, and they're back at the printing press right now, getting more copies made. So
aren't you having a good time?
Yeah, I mean, I can sit and read a book instead of talking to my wife at dinner time.
Well, I'm sure that wouldn't be any fun.
I don't even know why you said that, but that's all right. That British sense of humor sometimes goes over my head.
No, it went over your head. Well, listen, Fritz, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck. Go Broncos, as they say.
They do indeed.
And go philosophers too.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Nice to talk to both of you.
Okay. Fritz, ciao.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, what a delightful man he is. And I think that introduction is going to set us up very well for the next segment. But first, we're going to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening, of course, to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig. And don't forget to email us, giving us your ideas on things and just generally communicating.
And also become part of the new blog community.
I was going to get to that. I was going to give them the email address first, since we're talking about that.
Well, then go ahead.
Which is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Now, you give the blog information.
The blog is blogspot. Oops, I beg your pardon. onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
And that's really Peter's blog.
Well, it's only my blog because I was told I had to have a blog.
This is also your next segment to introduce. We're now going to move along to tasting Spanish wines in Spain, and one of our favorites is up next. Why don't you introduce it?
Well, we have two tracks we're going to run together. One is a very interesting new venture in the Rioja region called Roda, backed by some very wealthy people with some very determined views about what should be done to produce a new style Rioja. And then a couple who are partners, man and woman, it turns out, who will work together in the wine business for 25 years. And then at a point when they had a career fork in the road, they decided that instead of following either one of the forks, they'd take a whole new direction and they would produce just a singular wine from the Rioja region that would have different characteristics. So essentially we're continuing on with the philosophy idea, except that this is the philosophy that lies behind two of the most iconic modern wines from Spain's Rioja region. First up, it's Project Roda, and then right after that, Valenciso, and the players will introduce themselves.
8 years ago, we visited Bodegas Roda in the town of Aro, with an H on the beginning that's not pronounced, and we came back now to get an update on the story. And we're talking with the export sales manager, Gonzalo Lainez, whose name I just butchered, I'm sure, but who's been very patient and helped us with our tour of Spain. And here we are, meeting him for the first time and visiting Roda for the second time. 8 years later, the story continues, but perhaps Gonzalo, you can go back to the beginning for us.
First of all, I would like to thank you for the long trip to be here. The story of Roda begins in 1987 when the owners, they wanted a dream winery. They are business people in Spain, and the connection with the wine world is that they are importers of fine wines. Obviously, they got the bag and they wanted a dream winery. They decided to establish in Rioja. And the idea was producing a more modern wine, but by using the indigenous grapes from Rioja. Well, I have to say that the first vintage in the marketplace was 1992, released in 1996, despite the winery was founded in 87. It is because the former wines were not good enough to deserve the label Roda, and the owners, they didn't want to make that mistake. They come from Barcelona, but they rely on us. We are from Rioja, the technical team. And the idea was slightly different in the beginning. The idea of the owners was producing a single vineyard wine, but this is something not so easy to produce in Rioja, because it is very heterogeneous. We moved to a different idea, producing wines from a plot system. We own and control 28 different ecosystems, and we choose the best 17 every year. We produce 17 single vineyard wines, which will be blended after.
Now, there's a long-term future of this too, though, because Roda planted new vines about 18 years ago when the project began, and those are producing, but you're not making wine.
No, not really, because we really believe in all vines, so we don't want any wine under 30 years of age. I mean, our vineyards are 30 years old or over. We own some young vineyards. We are doing their viticulture and selling the clusters to other wineries. We don't want them until 30.
But long term, you think that superior viticulture that you're practicing will make Roda wines even better, right?
I think so, because our viticulture is very special. We have very good clonal selection. We own a nursery of 552 different biotypes of Tempranillo. So we are using our own clonal selection for the future, but we have to wait for another 30 years. So it's a long time.
Now, it's not just a single wine. It's a family of wines. One called Roda, one called Roda 1, and then another one I can't even begin to pronounce. Gonzalo, perhaps you would introduce us to each one of those and explain how they're different.
Well, we have three wines: Roda Reserva, Roda 1 Reserva, and Thirsion. Thirsion is a funny name for our iconic wine, twice the best wine of Spain. It's a 100% Tempranillo from some selected, extremely old vines. We have 10 pickers trained to harvest only some clusters. We know in some vines the tannins polymerized in the own grape. So what basically we do is we know how to identify them, and we produce a very big wine, but at the same time very smooth, very silky. So this is Thirsion. With regards to Roda and Roda 1, we produce 17 single vineyard wines. We age them separately. The winemaking process is base is roughly the same. And we are a panel of 6 tasters. During several blind tastings, we will choose some of the wines for Roda, and we will choose some of the wines for Roda 1, depending on the characteristics of the fruit, because Tempranillo is very versatile. Tempranillo sometimes ripes in red or in black. So if it ripes in red, they will go for Roda. If it ripes in black, they will go for Roda 1. And also we have the Garnacha. It has a red fruit character, goes for Roda, and the Graciano as well.
So it's really fascinating. What happened is, essentially, it's a reinvention, a modernization of winemaking in Rioja, but with it still firmly embedded in tradition.
Well, I think tradition is good. Problem of tradition is when it becomes routine. I think if we are able to keep the best, out of tradition with our modern winemaking, always trying to be transparent and always trying to reflect in the glass what it happened in the vineyard, this is great. So wine needs technology in order to produce something great, but at the same time very transparent.
And the great news, listeners, if you're just hearing about Roda for the first time, is that thanks to liquor business giant Cobrand, the wines are in wide distribution in the United States. And I'm going to ask Gonzalo to conclude by telling us what other parts of the world you can find it to.
As you said, Roda can be found widely in the United States by Cobrand Corporation. We're very happy because they are brand builders, but Roda can be also found in 53 countries so far. You can find it in Bermuda, for example, Guatemala, Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, Singapore, North Korea, Europe, Angola. So we are trying not to put all the eggs in the same basket.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, down the road, 12 years or so from now, there'll be a new Rota. Will there be new Rotas in between?
This is a question I like very much because I can tell you, and nobody knew about this, we are now producing a new wine in Ribera del Duero. We are just picking the grapes probably next week, and we want to produce 60,000 liters as a trial to see what's going on, because the idea of Rota is to grow, but we didn't want to produce more bottles in Rioja. So now we are moving to Ribera del Duero. We bought extremely old vineyards. We've been very lucky because we have very good raw material, and now we have to learn about it. So in a couple of years, I think I will be able to show you some of the new wines of Ribera del Duero.
Well, we made a stop there 8 years ago at a producer called Condado de Aza, and there's an iconic man in Spanish winemaking who's big in the Ribera del Duero. I've forgotten his name.
Alejandro Fernandez. We are very pleased to Alejandro Fernandez because he is one of the persons who showed how to produce wines in Ribera del Duero and how to sell them in the United States. So he's been a kind of ambassador of the not just Ribera del Duero but also Spanish wine in the United States. We are very pleased.
Well, that's fabulously breaking news. We can't wait to sample that one. You'll have to keep in touch with us and let us know when it's available. Gonzalo, thank you so much for talking to us, and also, I'll say on the air, for making this first part of our trip so special and helping us to get it all organized.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And now, after a short journey of only about 5 kilometers, here we are at Valenciso.
On the Menu is in Rioja. You know that because we were already at Rota. The next day we are at Valenciso, the name I am butchering altogether, but it's another vineyard where the approach to Rioja is different. It's a new and more modern approach, and we have the opportunity to talk to Luis Valentin, who is one of the founders of this enterprise, who has a long history in making wine and was born in Rioja. And I just want him to tell us a story of how this venture got off the ground and what it is they're trying to do.
Yes, as Peter said, I am from Rioja, and Valenciso is a company. It was founded in 1998. And the name is coming from my family name, which is Valentine, and the family name of my partner, she's Carmen Enciso. We have been working together for 23 years now. Both are born in Rioja, and we try to do something a little bit different from the Rioja standard wine, which, by the way, is very good, and it made the fame of Rioja in the world. But now we try to do something different, sharing the best of the classic and the best of the modern wines of Rioja.
Now, this is a total new venture for you and your partner, Carmen, when you began. Tell us when you actually began, and then now the dream of having a winery is being realized.
Well, yes, in fact, Carmen and I, we were working, as told before, we have been working together for 23 years now. At the beginning, we were working for an American corporation, Sigrun, and later on for French people. And in 1998, we decided to become independent and to make our dream, as everybody who loves wine, who works for wine, dreams of have his own wine. So now our dream is real. And in 1998, we decided to make Valenciso in Rioja. And step by step, takes a lot of time, but we are just at the point to arrive to the final end of our dream.
So after a whole decade of planting grapes and buying grapes and making wines in other people's wine facilities, for the first time in 2008, you will be producing in your own winery?
Yes, that's right, because the fact is, I don't want to speak about money. I prefer to speak about wine. But we wanted to be absolutely independent from the banks, to have the time and the place to make our own dream. So we began in rented facilities, and then we bought land, and we began to build our winery, which will be finished in 2 months' time. And step by step, as I said before, we buy vineyards, and now we are just at the edge of getting our dream.
So for the very first time, you'll be fermenting in unusual tanks in this modern era, but in your very own wine facility.
Yes, that's right. For Valenciso, even though it's a new facility, and in spite of the trend for using a stainless anywhere, we are using only concrete tanks because we think that it's better. It was used in the 40s, in the 50s, and later on. And now is the main difference of Valenciso with other wineries is we don't use stainless. We are using concrete tanks.
Well, you also said you're keeping the grapes whole through the fermentation process. So you're doing a number of what would be considered old-fashioned things just because of the way that you feel this will reflect in the wine?
Yes, it's true. Speaking about fashioning wine is always a little bit dangerous because wine has been in the life of the world for thousands and thousands of years, and everything has been already made. It's true now that the fact of going back to some old techniques is logical if you think that the technology helps to avoid bad wines, but I am not very sure if it is useful for making great wines. As even in the past, when there were no stainless cold fermentation and all the biochemics of wines, there were already great wines. So what we try to do is to follow our idea that 90% of the quality, and that is a number, no more, is on the grape.
Now, you also made another important decision that you would make only one wine. Explain what that means in terms of the quality of wine you're aiming for and essentially why you decided to go at it that way.
Well, in fact, when in our professional experience before, we used to work for companies producing more than 20 wines, different wines. So we were a little bit jealous of our friends from France. They produce just one wine. It looks easy to sell. At least it is so easy to explain. But it's more difficult from an enologic point of view because when you have 20 different wines, the quality is important, but you have a label for any kind of quality. When you make just one wine, you have to be consistent year after year for your customer. So sometimes you have to sacrifice the harvest. Sometimes you have to implement a lot of quality improvements used to keep the quality level of the wine. It's much more difficult making just one wine than making 20 different wines in a winery. People ordinarily, they think the contrary. They think one wine easy, 20 wines different. It's not like this. It's just on the contrary.
So what's happening is all your bets are on one wine, good or bad. I'm sorry. You're betting everything you have on the fact that your one wine will turn out be really good.
Yeah, that's right. That is when you make just one wine and you are new. Well, we are now already 10 years old, which is enough. But let's say that you cannot compromise with quality, you cannot compromise with the customer, because we don't have a legend to sustain the brand. We have to be very careful on that, and we have to offer year after year with the logical difference of the harvest the same level of quality.
Well, listeners, we have tasted 3 years, 2001, 2002, and 2004. If you see Valenciso's wines for 2003, don't buy them because they're fakes. There are no such wines. And this is undoubtedly a wine to follow. It's not produced in large quantity, but is in very wide distribution throughout Europe and in the United States. So we hope you'll look for it because it's a singular wine. My best guess is if you see this on a wine list, or if somebody ordered it without you seeing it from a wine list, you would not know that it was a wine from Rioja. What you would know is an excellent red wine.
Yes, maybe, but honestly speaking, we are from Rioja. Many people say you are so different, you don't look like a Rioja, but I argue always against that because the main thing in wine is the grape, and the grape is Tempranillo, and Tempranillo from Rioja Alta, which is the most prestigious area for Rioja. And to tell it's not a Rioja, maybe because it's so different from other classical Rioja, Humo de Rioja. But we try to look for acidity, for wines alive, for wine with freshness. And some people tell me, you are making French wine, and it's because of my French background, maybe. But it's not true. If you compare with the French wine, we are different. I'm not saying not even better. Better than many of them, but we are great wine, but 100% from Rioja, and typical Rioja, in a different way.
So this is a 10-year dream come true. Realizing now that the building that we saw still under construction will open, I think, in November. And then you have another project in the future to do with white wine in Rioja too.
Yes, the building, which at the end is not so important as people think. Most important thing is the wine and the grapes. Buildings is a matter of money, dirty money, if you allow me the word. You have to continue moving, and our next step is making white wine in small quantities. I am speaking about 2,000, 3,000 bottles, no more, with the local grape, which is Viura, which is not an easy grape for making wine. But we try to make something also different.
Well, I know you'll keep in touch with us and let us know what's going on. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And listeners, we're about to have lunch, and we're drinking a large format Valentisios 2002 as we do that, and we're enjoying every sip.
Thank you, on the contrary, thank you to you for taking the time to come to Spain and to visit us. It has been a pleasure, and I hope you a visit when everything is finished.
And with that, we will take a break.
But we hope you'll join us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're now moving on to what we said was sweet endings, and this is not sherry, and it's not liqueur. It's actually something very healthy to start with. The first interview is by the founder of Cherish, which has, as you can probably imagine, having to do with the fruit cherries. Hello, Ryan Haggart. You are the co-founder and head of marketing for a company called Cherish, spelled capital C-H-E-R-R and small I-S-H. And I guess it refers to cherish, like wow.
And, yes, it does.
And cherry, which is what it's made of, with two R's.
Exactly.
Could you describe what your product is about? I must say, by the way, to start it all off, that it tastes very good.
Oh, good. Well, that's a great start. That's the most important thing.
What could be wrong with cherry juice?
Well, our idea is it's similar to other antioxidant drinks or antioxidant juices. We're 100% natural. We don't add anything to it. It's just the Montmorency concentrate, and what it is it's one of the highest antioxidant fruits available in the United States.
Now, there is a way of measuring this, and do you have the standard, what is it called, FARC?
It's called the OROC scale.
OROC, yeah.
Yeah, the OROC scale was created by Brunswick Labs, and it's the only scale that can read and measure the antioxidants in a certain property. We're the only juice that is on the market right now that the content in our bottle, antioxidant levels are measured and placed on the OROC scale and actually placed on the bottle.
And it doesn't say, though, how much of this you have to consume.
It says
that in the literature I got that you have to consume it every day regularly in a certain amount, but it didn't tell me how much.
The FDA believes that we should have anywhere from 3,500 to 5,000 antioxidant units a day. And in the Cherish bottle, you can get almost up to 6,200 antioxidant units a day if you drink the entire 10.5 ounces.
Okay, that's the bigger bottle.
That is the bigger bottle.
That's a lot of juice.
that is definitely a lot of juice.
And how many calories are in that?
Per serving, you have roughly right around 130, and that's the entire bottle.
Oh, that's not bad.
No, not at all. So, and it's all, and there are some sugars, but it's all natural sugars, no fructose, no complex sugars or anything like that. It's just all, everything that Mother Nature intended us to ingest.
Now, for those people who are not ODing on cherries, you also mix it with other things?
We do. We have a couple of all-natural flavors. We use a raspberry flavor, which is just great, adds a little bit of sweetness to it. And then we also have a blueberry flavor. So it's a blueberry and cherry as well as a raspberry and cherry.
And you use these Montmorency cherries, which are sour cherries.
Yeah, they're the pie cherry, if you will.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
The nice thing we've learned about antioxidants when it comes with fruit, there's a little slogan that's the redder, the better.
Yeah, well, there's a term for that, whatever the color is. What's it called? You know, the nutraceutical.
Oh, I don't know if I'm familiar with the term.
Yeah, well, it's a nutraceutical it takes its value from the color, and the redder it is, the better, apparently.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, and it's definitely being proven. There's even with pomegranates, it's being proven that the Palm Wonderful is a very, very high antioxidant pomegranate, whereas some pomegranates that come from other parts of the world are a lot lighter in color and don't have that same antioxidant quality that wonderful pomegranate has.
Yeah. Well, now let's just, for those people who haven't really done much antioxidanting, give us a brief primer on antioxidants and why they're so important.
Well, the idea is everybody has free radicals running through our systems. Free radicals are when our molecules lose the oxygen molecule. It's been stolen by somebody else. And it starts a chain reaction through your body because now it needs to find its oxygen molecule. So it steals from somebody else and it starts this breakdown of your cells.
Oh, dear.
What antioxidants do, they come in and they replace that missing oxygen molecule. So they kind of come in and cap that missing part so that the chain reaction stops. And the chain reaction by the free radicals have resulted from anything from neurodegenerative diseases, from anything from arthritis to some forms of cancers, to anything like that, that slowly breaks down your body. And so the antioxidant comes in and seals that missing oxygen molecule.
So it's really important stuff, huh?
Yes, definitely.
I mean, has anybody, the FDA, proves these health claims for this juice?
Nothing's been fully certified in terms of the actual content of how much you need to drink every single day. We're not placed alongside the vitamin C's quite yet, but they are studying it, and that should be something that'll happen in the near future, I guarantee.
I mean, do you ever get complaints from people who say that their arthritis isn't improved with this juice?
No, I've never heard that. Especially on our website, cherish.net, we have a lot of witnesses that have showed a lot of improvement, especially with rheumatoid arthritis, as well as gout. Gout sufferers for a long time have known the health and healing benefits of cherries.
Uh-huh.
We have yet to hear anybody say this stuff doesn't work and I don't like it and it's made me worse, that's for sure.
Oh, no, it tastes good.
Now, where did the idea come from?
It started a little while ago. We had a small fruit brokerage company where we specialized in selling through produce specialty items through produce areas. And one of our growers actually had an idea of this. He didn't know how to properly market it or where to go next. We asked him, could we run with it? And he said, by all means, give it a try. And as we started researching more and more, we learned more about antioxidants. We learned more about the fact that what's on the market isn't necessarily what you need. And other than the Palm Wonderfuls of the world, we really had a hard time finding somebody that was being honest. And it kept growing. The interest was there. And so we just kept taking one more step.
See, I don't even know what Palm Wonderful is.
Oh, Palm Wonderful is that's the leading all-natural antioxidant drink.
That's
right
the one
now.
That comes in a funny-shaped bottle?
Yes, the one that's got, the double bubble, if you will.
Okay, that's the one.
We've
had that. That's very expensive, so you switched to buying pomegranate juice in much larger containers because the small ones are much too expensive down at Whole Paycheck.
Too true.
Now, how do people find out more about where they can get a hold of Cherish?
Right now, if you come to our website, it's www.cherish.net. If you go there, we have a list of our stores. You can order directly from the website. We'll ship to anywhere you'd like, any quantity you'd like. We can handle that for you.
Okay, so is it in places like Whole Foods and various?
We're working with Whole Foods, some local, some larger chains, Kroger's, things like that, in order to hopefully get it done by the end of the year.
Well, now, where's it going to go? Are you going to just keep adding new flavors, or is it going to be a single
product? We have a few different ideas. We have one where we're working with a recovery. There's the nice thing about Cherish is not only the antioxidants, but it also has an anti-inflammatory. The skin, the Montmorency Cherry, has a natural anti-inflammatory. It's great for post-workouts. Obviously not right after you get done with your long run. Do you want to chug a big thing of cherry juice? But a couple hours later with a little bit of protein, it's great for recovery. So we're coming out with where we're going to water it down a little bit, sweeten it up a little bit. It'll be called Cherish Sport.
Okay.
Will be an idea that we're working on. That'll be our next introduction, and then we're actually
listeners.
Going
you heard that here.
Right. What
scoop?
What I did with it, candidly, is because it is a very rich juice. Is I put some sparkling mineral water in it about equal parts of Cherish and sparkling mineral water, and it's much more refreshing that way. And
he does that with everything.
No, I do that with orange juice as well. Well, the people, wasn't it Busy Lizzie?
Fizzy Lizzie.
They said that's how they came up with the idea for their product.
Yeah. I think it was dry soda.
Was it dry soda?
Dry soda.
I don't know
that.
Who it was.
But anyhow, well, you know, this you're certainly on trend. I mean, everybody wants to drink things that are high in antioxidants. I could not test the anti-inflammatory qualities of it since Peter drank it all.
Well, we'll have to send you some more.
Yeah, well, anyhow, Ryan, thank you so much for talking to us about it. You must feel like you're on a good track here.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, thank you for having me on. Well, we do feel like we're going down the right road, that's for sure.
That's great.
And say hi to your dad, and I'm sure he's proud of you.
Oh, I will definitely. Thank you very much.
And he'll be even prouder of you when he hears what a great job you did on the air. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Bye, Ryan.
Goodbye.
And now we were so taken with this next book, beautiful, beautiful book, and also with its author, and I think you will be too. So let's listen to Frozen Desserts. Francisco Maguire, this book is just so gorgeous. It's called Frozen Desserts, and it's published by the Culinary Institute of America. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You are born in Mexico City.
Born and raised, right.
Born and raised. A wonderful city if they could get rid of the pollution.
Yeah, and the crime.
Yeah.
And some of the 25 million people.
Yeah. Just spread them out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I could spend half my life in the archaeological museum, but I noticed
place.
A big difference between when I was last there and then when I went a couple of years ago. And it was in the crime thing was different. But anyhow, your mother is, do I have this backward? Your mother is American and your father is from Spain?
Yes, that's correct. My mom is actually Italian-American. Her parents were immigrants. And my father is, he was born in Spain at a very young age. His family emigrated to Mexico during the Civil War.
Well, you've got good food genes there.
Yeah, well, that's what got me all started with this.
So was there a family tradition in the kitchen?
Well, yeah. I mean, and it was, I didn't even decide to become a chef until I was like in my late teens. It just made sense. I mean, the cooking was always there. I was cooking, my family was cooking, and there were always these huge meals, as you probably know, with these cultures. And it just made complete sense to me that would be the path that I would take. That would be something that would be enjoyable for me to do as a career. So it just it worked itself out like that.
Well, you have a pretty sterling resume. Where did you work before?
Well, before the Culinary Institute of America, I was the executive pay chef at the French Laundry.
just a tiny little old place in a tiny little pokey
yeah.
little place in California.
little restaurant in California. But I was also in charge of desserts for the bakery, for Bouchon Bakery, and the bistro. So I had supervised that too. So very long days, but it was for me as far as industry wise, it was the biggest and most biggest learning experience I've ever had in the industry. And I mentioned industry separately because here in school, we do teach, but as far as going out there in the industry, that was like the biggest, most important professional move.
And
it
you
was
said
just huge.
you said you loved, drawn to teaching, and interestingly enough, I mean, you, when I asked you about this book, is it for professionals, and you said, yes, but it would also inspire, or should also inspire, others, right?
Well, that, you know, the point was, you know, what the publisher and I had come up with was that we would come up with this piece that could be used for, yes, professionals, students, but also to for it to be an inspirational piece for anybody who would come across it, you know, obviously food enthusiasts. So that was, you know, we didn't want to, well, okay, let's try to make everybody happy so that, you know, they would all be out going out to buy the book, but just for it to be able to satisfy a couple of different areas, and I think we accomplished it. I mean, I'm certainly very proud of the book.
The photograph.
Before we came on the air, you were talking about professional freezers, and then a device called a Parco Jet.
Yes.
Which itself is a several hundred dollar investment. Are there desserts in the book that you can make without that, or is this basically starting up? If you want to use this book, you're going to have to make that investment?
I don't think that, you know, first of all, if you can afford a Paco Jet, I would definitely make the purchase, because it's not, Paco Jet is not just for frozen items. I mean, I know a lot of chefs that make mousses in it, they grind their spices in it to a powder, and it's useful not just for frozen desserts. But if I had to say, well, you know, could these recipes easily be translated to a home use ice cream machine, I would say perhaps, but it would have to be top of the line home use ice cream machine, because home ice cream machines are very limited by what they can do. They're slow, they don't have a lot of that freon that goes that freezes around the barrel of the ice cream machine, which, you know, it's very expensive. That's why, you know, small professional ice cream machines are thousands and thousands of dollars, just because of the machinery and the mechanics that go into it to making like a perfectly smooth finished product.
But the deal is, you want something that is going to freeze fast, and it's going to keep it frozen, and it's just going to do the job that a small ice cream machine is just not going to do.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like you want to obtain the smallest possible ice crystal size. That's what determines the smoothness or the graininess of a finished product, is, you know, how small are these little frozen ice particles in the ice cream that are what gives it its consistency. So, you know, the faster the machine goes, the smaller the ice crystal is going to be, the better the mouthfeel you're going to have.
Now, let's go back a little bit. Could you just define what you mean by frozen dessert?
Well, a frozen dessert or like a particular frozen dessert, because frozen desserts is, you know, any dessert that is served frozen, and it can range from an ice cream, sorbet, sherbet, static frozen, like a popsicle or a granita, which is a scraped ice, or you can even go to still frozen, which are like frozen mousses, frozen parfaits, semifreddos, you know, those frozen desserts that do not require a machine such as a batch freezer to produce. So,
you know, there seems to be some revival of popsicles, gourmet popsicles.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of this comfort thing?
Well, I think it has to do with that. I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of chefs and, you know, regular people going back to these classic foods, and in my book I did include a few of popsicles. Like, we have a couple that use Pinot Grigio. We have one that's a Gewürztraminer popsicle with tamarind, like grown-up pop.
It sounds really grown-up.
Yeah.
These are so absolutely gorgeous. For somebody who's never even thought of making a frozen dessert, I'm just enraptured.
Which one are you looking at? The
mascarpone, sherbetone, praline ice cream, burnt sugar cone, Tyrone gelato cone, oatmeal ice cream cone. And then, I mean, you pull in all the techniques that you do, the sugar work.
Well, that's the other part too. It's not just frozen desserts. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, like plated frozen desserts. So there's the other components too.
This one is really yuzu sorbet with cotton candy and black sesame seeds. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. So you're going down Nan's favorite pathway, which is to make frozen desserts out of traditionally savory items, shall we say.
Yeah, but the trick with that is that you have to be smart when you do that, because if it's too sweet, and it can become very weird to eat. Like I made it a point that the recipes are in the book that are traditionally savory items, that they not be too sweet. They're just sweet enough, because you need the sugar to keep the consistency right. But that they could and should be served as either an amuse-bouche or as a, you know, between courses, as a palate cleanser, but not as a dessert per se.
I'd like for you to be my resident dessert maker, because then she could have
you make eggplant ice cream anytime she wanted it.
Hey, that's an interesting concept.
I've always said that. I mean, way before the savory got into the sweet category, uh-huh. When I first met Peter, which was like 36 years ago, I said, you know, why don't they make ice creams and flavors I like right. Eggplant and asparagus?
I'm sure in your trip, Ben, you're going to find somebody
Wiley Dufresne did that edamame ice cream.
Was very
excited about that. Now let's make it really hard.
That was
for
Sam
you.
Mason's recipe.
Yeah,
used to be.
We're going to make it really hard because you get to pick two favorites out of this whole big fat book, and then tell us what they are, and then tell us why.
Well, you know, ironically, one of my favorites is burnt milk ice cream. What it is, it's really just milk and sugar, and you cook it to reduce it, to concentrate the flavor of the milk. And then you can either scrape it like a granita, or you can churn it in a batch freezer. And the flavor is just so intense and like milky. And you have, you know, when the milk is cooking in the pot, a lot of the solids in the milk, they go through what is called a Maillard reaction, which is almost like caramelizing the solids and the lactose in it. So you get this very like caramel milky flavor. It's just amazing. So that's one of them. And it's so simple, too. It's just the two ingredients, you know, milk and sugar. That's it.
It reminds me of dulce de leche, right?
It's in principle, that's more or less how dulce de leche is made.
Yeah.
And as far as a second favorite item, I would have to say the demerara sugar ice cream. Demerara is a type of unrefined
right, yeah, we used to get that as brown sugar in England when I was growing up in wartime, and then it just sort of got civilized away.
Yes.
And you get Domino brown sugar, which isn't the same thing at all.
It's not, because it doesn't have the complexity that demerara sugar had. As you know, demerara has all of these, I don't know, it's like it's sugar, all right, but it has all, it's like when you taste wine and it has all of these different flavors
The junk's still left. All the junk's still left in there.
But it's the good junk, though.
Yeah, it's the good junk that has taste.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you say?
Are we
going to make dessert tonight?
No, I mean, this is the kind of dessert that I'd eat, because I don't have a very strong sweet tooth.
Mm-hmm.
But you said that this book was meant to inspire, and I'll tell you, Francisco, it certainly inspired me. You have a lot of artist genes, too, I believe.
Well, when I was deciding what career path to take, I was it was either going to be art or it was going to be cooking.
Same.
So my dad said, if you're an artist, you're on your own.
So. Okay, so you became both.
Yeah.
You're a food artist, except the food's edible.
Right, and that's the thing. It's like have to have some of that when you're a chef. So
I mean, it's wonderfully edible. I mean, it just one picture after the other, just more and more gorgeous. We're looking forward to our upcoming trip to I don't know whether it'll be upcoming or not. By the time this guy's out of there, we'll probably be back. We'll be thinking about the desserts you told us that we might expect. Some of the great places that we're going.
And Francisco, you know, I'm sorry that we don't have like weekly meetings together or something. you'd be somebody I'd really enjoy hanging with.
Well, you know, you can. I'm in charge of one of the restaurants here on campus, the Apple Pie Bakery Cafe.
Oh, good, right.
And we, you know, we're full fledged cafe. Like, we have breads, breakfast pastries, desserts, ice creams, obviously, chocolates. We have a full lunch menu, and we're open 5 days a week. And I'll be happy to have you come over and taste some ice cream.
Well, we'll have to put that out. We'll have to put that on a list of places to go the next time we're in New York. We look forward to it, and we can take pictures, and we can talk about the real items.
please let me know when you're here. That'd be
okay.
Great.
Okay. Francisco, thank you for taking time to talk to us.
No, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. So what do we say here? Not adios. What do we say?
Till next time.
Till next time. In Spanish, how do we say that?
Hasta pronto.
Hasta pronto.
Hasta pronto. Mm-hmm. See, in Italian, we just got back from Italy, so it's alla prossima volta.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Same, similar. Okay, then.
All right.
Till then.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye. Well, that's a major program. We've covered a lot of ground there, Robert.
We did. And these two winemakers truly are, the two winemakers we talked about are iconic. Fritz Ahlhoff's book is highly recommended. It's a very interesting story. Don't let philosophy put you off. It's packed with interesting information, little known facts, and an approach to thinking about and talking about and sampling wine that I think you'll find really new. And then, don't hesitate to drink Cherish and then finish it off with wonderful, wonderful, wonderful looking frozen desserts from our friend Francis Magoya. So another great program. We hope you enjoyed it. You'll join us same time, same place next week. And just for a trailer for you for the future, On the Menu bagged interviews with four of the very top chefs in Spain. And we're getting organized to have a translator on board so we can bring those interviews to you in English as well as Spanish. So do look forward to those as soon as we can get that organized. And now, Mrs. Rabbit, it's time to go for another week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week, listeners, we hope.
Bye-bye.